once had a 3-year string of near daily Goodwill shopping fueled by a personal style rule that every accessory or piece of clothing had to match the color she'd chosen that day. If her outfit was green, then her earrings, shoes, and tights all had to match, down to her rings. Joey liked to share her opinions on everything from Freddie Mercury to eye makeup to the best dance moves when making a Facebook workout video to the Prince song When Doves Cry. "She's the funniest person I've ever known. She's literally a ball of fire," said her best friend, Emma Hurley. A boyfriend had introduced Joey to pills in high school, then heroin shortly after that. They were part of the Hidden Valley group of early opioid users that included the late Scott Roth and Janine's son, Bobby. Over the next decade, Emma would lose 3 close friends and 10 acquaintances to opioid overdose. "A friend of many of the Hidden Valley users told me he no longer asks what happened when people phone him to say that another friend has passed. I already know," he tells them. "Hidden Valley was where it all started with my friends," Emma said. "I just happened to say no to the harder stuff. You'd be at a party and it was, hey, try this, have a beer, pills, cocaine, anything you could use to get a little bit higher." She separated herself from the group when IV heroin became part of the mix, she said. "It was just overwhelming, the ups and downs of clean Joey and relapsed Joey," Emma said, recalling that supposedly sober Joey had talked her into sharing an apartment in 2013 and swore that she no longer used heroin. "I wouldn't have let her move in with me if I had known," Emma said. "Eventually she'd do heroin right in front of me. It was tough." They parted ways over a missing $6, and for 6 months they didn't speak. "This too shall pass," Joey had written around that time on her Facebook page. "It might pass like a kidney stone, but it will pass." Joey was not only still using, but she had also allowed an abusive drug dealer and the dealer's girlfriend to move in with her in exchange for drugs, unbeknownst to her dad. "She was ashamed of how low she'd gotten herself in her own eyes," Jamie said. She and Sherry Hartman, a Hope volunteer, worked to find Joey a residential treatment bed, according to the new Hope policy of volunteers working only in pairs, which allowed them to share the heartache as well as the tasks. Several interventions later, including a visit with her at the emergency room, the women persuaded Joey, battered and with bruises around her neck, to move away from the dealer. As Jamie helped her pack up, they found some of Tessa's clothes. Sherry Hartman talked her psychiatrist's husband into taking Joey on again as a Suboxone patient. He'd once prescribed her Vivitrol during an early period of sobriety before she turned 26. Joey's divorced parents shared the cost of the prescription, visits, and lab work, and uninsured Joey applied to the hospital-run clinic for charity care. But Joey bumped into treatment barriers in March 2017, just as Tess had with waiting lists and funding hurdles. The only inpatient facility willing to accept her at the moment was a free, faith-based program in Charlotte that did not permit the use of Suboxone or any other drugs. To get into the rehab, Joey decided to wean herself off MAT, even though she knew the dangers. And while Jamie tried to be encouraging, privately, both she and Sherry worried. "She was so motivated and wanted to do it, and we all felt like it would be a really good fit," Sherry said, even though the MAT tapering presented a catch-22. "Her addiction was so severe, I don't think she was fighting withdrawal symptoms as much as she was fighting her mental illness demons, including bipolar depression and probably PTSD," Sherry said. In her experience, those who have serious psychiatric problems on top of their addictions and who also use multiple drugs, not just opioids, are the very hardest cases to treat, even with MAT. In an ideal world, Joey would have gone from Vivitrol, which lasts about a month, directly to rehab, with the shot providing a bridge to fight her cravings, Sherry said. Jamie worried too, telling Joey's dad, "I don't know what makes her think she can do it now when she couldn't do it before, or just doing the same old thing here." Her dad pointed out that Joey had never had much tolerance for pain. She felt she couldn't get off anything unless she was on something else. "But that's what a lot of drug addicts do. It's the addictive personality," Danny Gilbert said. "I think it's asinine to tell a drug addict you've got to be clean before you can come to my facility." In the treatment center's defense, it couldn't afford to have medical staff on hand to supervise detox and/or medications, Jamie said. Joey had two halves of a Suboxone pill left. She was trying to stretch them out, self-weaning in preparation for rehab. The next day, Danny Gilbert was traveling in Northern Virginia with his wife when he took a frantic call from Joey. She and her boyfriend had had another fight, and she felt her resolve slipping. "Daddy, I don't want to die," she told him. They argued on the phone. A few hours later, she texted her father. "I just left Goodwill. Can you please transfer $4 so I can get a pack of cigarettes, please?" 8 minutes later, he texted Joey back. "Say what you want, but everyone loves you. We want you back. Get cigarettes, but get your life back, not more BS." The next morning, Sherry phoned Jamie, but had a hard time choking out the news. Joey had lain inside a Roanoke County house for almost 8 hours before 911 was called. Police were investigating, but the so-called friends she was using with had cleaned up the scene, fearing prosecution, after Joey passed out. She died of an overdose of illicit methadone on March 26, 2017, the 19th lethal overdose in the Roanoke County suburbs so far that year. She was 27 years old. She fought hard against the demon of addiction, and God has delivered her to a place of unconditional love, laughter, and no more pain, her mother wrote in her obituary. "Watch over us, Joe, and smile down on us until we can hold you in our arms again." 2 days later, the moms of the Hidden Valley fraternity of users, only a few of their sons and daughters now among the living, took their seats among the memorial service pews. Patricia wept, marveling at how much the Gilbert family loved their troubled daughter. Even with all the sorrow she'd caused them, they had tried so hard to keep her safe. She said, "I was thinking to myself, if this was Tess, how would you feel right now, family?" She firmly believed that Tess still had the potential to recover, to become a loving mother to her son. Patricia was still showing her grandson family pictures, coaching him to say "Mama" when she pointed to Tess. But new custody issues were emerging that Patricia kept secret from Tess, and she knew that Tess could die before they were resolved. She had already chosen the spot where she would sprinkle her daughter's ashes, if it came to that, at a confluence of the Cape Fear River and the ocean, where they had loved walking the dogs and searching for sand dollars, not far from the family's old beach house. 6 weeks later, Patricia intercepted a Facebook message between a Las Vegas drug dealer and Tess, now communicating through her rehab roommate's phone. She was still at the facility the next day when Patricia fired off a letter expressing her disappointment to her daughter. "If she fails, she is on her own," she told me. It was Mother's Day, 2017. Tess wished Patricia a happy one via text. "I love you," Tess wrote, "but this is bullshit, all of it, especially being away from her son. I'm going to find a way home," she said. She signed the text to her mother ominously, using her street name, Sweet Tea. Chapter 12. Brother, Wrong or Right? In the Odyssey, Homer described a drug that would lull all pain and anger and bring forgetfulness of every sorrow. A Victorian poet said taking opium felt as if his soul was being rubbed down with silk. In Virginia's coal fields, a long-addicted OxyContin user spoke in hyperbolic terms about the first time she crossed paths with the molecule back in 1998. "I thought, that's all I need from here on out. I will live life like this," Rosemary Hopkins, in recovery and on MAT under the care of Van Zee since 2009, told me in a counseling room at Sister Beth Davies' office. Rosemary had a theory about the way corporations had been allowed to unleash a flood of painkillers, a notion I heard more than once as I traversed Appalachia's former factory and mining towns. "For that strong of a drug to be everywhere you looked," she said, "it was like the government was controlling it, trying to get rid of the lowlives." She laughed when she said it, but I could see what she was getting at. Although her hypothesis was somewhat different, it was a version of what federal prosecutor Andrew Bassford meant when, quoting President Garfield, he proposed that governments fail their citizens not because of stupidity or faulty doctrines, but because of internal decay and rigidification. "I used to do 80 cases in a good year, but in recent years, it's been 26, 40, whatever, Bassford said in April 2017. So the amount of cases being done does not match the problem, and we have found ways to make it more difficult to do cases, more boxes that have to be checked, more things to do in the service of perfection. When I offered that I was leaving his office after our third interview, depressed, again, he said, "Well, you should be. Rehab is a lie. It's a multi-billion dollar lie. An annual $35 billion lie, according to a New York Times expose, of a recovery industry if found to be unevenly regulated, rapacious, and largely abstinence-focused, when multiple studies show outpatient MAT is the best way to prevent overdose death. I'm afraid we don't have very good data on outcomes from residential programs," said John Kelly, the Harvard researcher. While research supports users remaining in their home environments on outpatient MAT, desperate families continue to grasp for cures offered by companies marketing abstinence-only rehabs. Sherry Hartman told me, "Part of it is when you spend that much money, you think it's going to work. But it is killing people for that myth to be out there that the only true cure is abstinence." I hope the stories of Ronnie Jones and his victims would illuminate the ruts in both a criminal justice system that pursues a punishment-fits-all plan when the truth is much more complicated, and a strained medical system that overtreats people with painkillers until the moment addiction sets in and healthcare scarcity becomes the rule. I hope, too, that my interview with Jones would help answer Christy Fernandez's questions about what led to her son Jesse's premature death. Was Ronnie Jones really the monster the law enforcement officials made him out to be? Had the statewide corrections behemoth that returns 2,000 ex-offenders a year to Virginia's cities, counties, and towns played a role in his revolving door of failures? I had come to interview Ronnie Jones expecting I would have 2 hours, no recording devices allowed. On the day of our meeting, though, the visit stretched from morning into late afternoon, with the prison handler monitoring our visit from the other side of a glass wall and inexplicably allowing us to talk for more than 6 hours. I had the better part of a day to try to discern how a sleepy agricultural county nestled in the Blue Ridge Mountains with covered bridges and lovingly preserved 200-year-old log homes had gone from having a handful of heroin users to hundreds in a few short months, and how much Ronnie Jones was to blame for it. Understandably guarded at first, Ronnie, 39, was gentlemanly and polite throughout the visit. During the 2 years he'd spent there, he said, he spent his time working out, studying Arabic and Swahili, and reading the works of Guy Johnson, Eric Jerome Dickey, and Maya Angelou. "On my way to the prison, I've been listening to the audiobook of Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow," I told him, "the seminal book on mass incarceration that likens the war on drugs to a system of racial control comparable to slavery in Jim Crow." "I've read the New Jim Crow twice," Ronnie said. He'd also read lawyer Brian Stevenson's majestic Just Mercy, a memoir about his work against the racial bias and economic inequities inherent in the criminal justice system, which included efforts on behalf of falsely accused death row inmates. Ronnie said, "It had me crying when I read it." These books we had both read challenged the tough-on-crime government narrative of the past 40 years, one that fostered the shift in public spending from health and welfare programs to a massive system of incarceration, with a fivefold increase in imprisonment and correction spending that soared from $6.9 billion in 1980 to $80 billion today. Whereas Bill Metcalf, the ATF agent largely responsible for Jones's 23-year prison sentence, took inspiration for his life's work from the image of the brain frying like an egg and Nancy Reagan's Just Say No slogan, Alexander and Stevenson saw fear-mongering and institutional racism in mandatory minimum sentences, three-strike sentencing laws, the abolishment of parole, and stop-and-frisk policing. This was Ronnie's third time in prison. He already knew that one in three black men was destined to end up incarcerated, only to find himself branded as a felon and second-class citizen the moment he got out, blocked from the mainstream economy, and propelled into a dystopian loop of jail, joblessness, and back to jail. He knew that drug-involved offenders, who represent half the incarcerated population, had a recidivism rate of 75%. His own story was a case in point. "We can't arrest our way out of this problem," I'd heard again and again, from everyone from police chiefs to public health providers. But that sentiment seemed to apply only to the mostly white group of opioid users who were dealing or committing property crimes to stave off dope sickness, not to people like Ronnie, in prison for armed heroin distribution, or to the majority of other black and brown people arrested for selling the drugs, even though they were statistically less likely to use or to deal. 3/4 of federal drug offenders are black or Hispanic, while 57% of state-imprisoned drug offenders are people of color. Why had blacks failed to become ensnared in opioid addiction? That question was addressed in 2014 data issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Doctors didn't trust people of color not to abuse opioids, so they prescribed them painkillers at far lower rates than they did whites. It's a case where racial stereotyping actually seems to be having a protective effect, marveled researcher Dr. Andrew Kolodny of Brandeis University. Put another way, by 2014, while young whites were dying of overdose at a rate 3 times higher than they did in 2002, the death rate for people of color was relatively unchanged. If, as Shannon Monette had proposed, the hollowing out of the predominantly white working class was the kindling in the heroin epidemic, and the mounds of opioid pills in America's communal medicine chest was the spark, I was beginning to wonder whether the fragile transition of 10,000 prisoners a week from state and federal prisons into U.S. communities fanned the flames of the fire. At the same time that Ronnie and I were speaking, the city of Winchester was launching the region's first drug court just a half hour north of the heart of Ronnie's Woodstock heroin ring. It was designed not only to connect offenders to treatment, including MAT, but also to help them access free housing and taxi vouchers to get to work, a serious barrier in rural areas, the latter paid for by grants from the local Rotary Club. While the government's response to the opioid crisis had been molasses slow, mired in bureaucracy, funding woes, and slow to close treatment gaps, here was an example of volunteers stepping in to patch up the holes. Winchester was becoming a magnet for people in recovery across the state, including ex-offenders who came for treatment and ended up staying because of its multitude of halfway houses, 14 in a city of just 27,000 people, and of newly announced jobs. Amazon was soon to open a warehouse and distribution center in the county, and Procter & Gamble was building a Bounce fabric softener factory 20 minutes north. The fastest-growing church in town was led by an ex-offender and opioid addict, a charismatic pastor who held Sunday services at the downtown mall in a bar. What if Winchester's Rotarians and drug court champions had been around to assist Ronnie Jones when he got out of prison, instead of one probation officer responsible for keeping up with 104 ex-offenders on her rolls? Right away, they run into issues of having a paycheck that doesn't cover rent, utilities, and food, not to mention their court fines and child support arrears, and that's when the issues really start, said Ronnie's probation officer, who asked not to be named because she wasn't authorized to speak. That's usually when they commit new crimes. In 2016, the Woodstock office had 2 probation officers tasked with doing monthly check-ins, field visits, and drug screening for 204 people, though an additional officer was scheduled to join the team. Many ex-offenders have no driver's license and no way to get one until they pay back the thousands they owe in court fines and child support arrears. In some states, people with drug charges are permanently barred from getting food stamps, a holdover from a 1996 federal ban. Virginia is one of 26 states that have eased some restrictions on the ban. "Think about it. You can do without a roof, but you can't do without food," said Mark Schroeder, a repeat drug-dealing offender and recovering crack addict who successfully opened his own garage door hanging business in the Shenandoah Valley in 2016 after a 10-year federal prison stint. He and hundreds like him were given reduced sentences following the 2015 decision Johnson v. United States, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that redefined the status of armed career criminals. Schroeder said, "To feed yourself, you're either going to rob somebody or you're going to go back to dealing or prostitution. I've been there and done it myself. The whole thing is designed for you to come back." What if Ronnie's re-entry had been managed not by an overburdened and apathetic system, but instead by workers from Brian Stevenson's Equal Justice Initiative, which sends clients to felon-friendlier cities like Seattle? There, jobs and harm reduction measures are more plentiful, and police divert low-level drug and prostitution offenders who are addicted from prosecution before they're booked, assisting with housing, case management, and employment services. Such a two-pronged approach not only addresses the need for former drug dealers to find legitimate work, but also works to dry up the demand for drug dealing. It makes a huge difference, Stevenson told me. If we reduced our prison population by 25%, that's $20 billion we could save. And if we invested half of that in treatment, we could really increase people's likelihood of success. In the 1970s, America decided to deal with drug addiction and dependence as a crime problem rather than a health problem. Because it was popular to find a new community of people to criminalize, Stevenson explained, and everybody was preaching the politics of fear and anger. As that narrative of addicts as criminals further embedded itself into the national psyche, the public became indifferent to an alternative response that could have eased treatment barriers, he said. As an example, he cited Portugal, which decriminalized all drugs, including cocaine and heroin, in 2001. Adding housing, food, and job assistance, and now has the lowest drug use rate in the European Union, along with significantly lowered rates of drug-related HIV and overdose deaths. In Portugal, the resources that were once devoted to prosecuting and imprisoning drug addicts were funneled into treatment instead. Ronnie Jones's story was tough to fit into a neat arc of redemption. But it seemed to turn on poor decision-making fueled by family instability and quick-fix desires. His rap sheet began with a felony grand larceny charge the summer before his senior year of high school. He'd borrowed a car from a girlfriend, then used that car to meet up with another girl, resulting in a catfight and ultimately his arrest and conviction for theft. While he was on probation for that offense, he nabbed another felony for driving another car, sans license, that contained stolen goods. Growing up, he told me, he wanted Nikes instead of Reeboks, steak instead of hot dogs and fish sticks. He wished for a closer relationship with his single mother, a hospital nursing assistant and later nurse. But she got along better with his easier-going little brother Thomas, who was into music and sports and was promoted to his school's gifted program. Ronnie said, "I get jealous of my brother, of his attention from my mom. I get mad at her and threaten all the time. I'll go live with my dad." Ronnie was obstinate to a fault, recalled Thomas Jones III, and would talk back to teachers and to their mom. He told me, "The weird thing is, he wasn't a very bad kid. It was more of his total disregard at times for authority. I learned that it was best just to try to stay out of his warpath." Now a music promoter based in Charlotte, Thomas Jones said his brother had a brilliant business mind and had helped him, when he was younger, with his advanced math homework, even as he refused to do his own. Their family was not without connections. His uncle, Petey Jones, was a linebacker on the 1971 state champion team memorialized in the movie Remember the Titans, which was set against a backdrop of racial tensions brought on by the integration of Alexandria's high schools. In 1990, his maternal grandfather, Thomas Pete Jones Sr., was such a fierce fighter for equal housing that then-President George H.W. Bush met with him and other residents to discuss ways to rid Alexandria's public housing units of drugs. Ronnie and his brother grew up in Section 8 housing in Northern Virginia, moving every few years as their mom worked her way up to better jobs. A no-holds-barred fight between the brothers when Ronnie was 15 taxed his mother's nerves to the breaking point. She sent him to live in Alexandria with his father, dropping his belongings on the curb in trash bags, and telling his dad, as Ronnie recalled it, "He's your responsibility now, I'm done." Ronnie's father and uncle were regular drug users. He remembered them going down into the basement regularly to freebase powder cocaine. 6 months after moving in with his dad, Ronnie moved in with his maternal grandmother, Rosie, his favorite relative. Her husband was an Air Force mechanic who took Ronnie to air shows at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland and let him sit in the pilot's seat. He was fascinated with airplanes and wanted to be an Air Force pilot. It was a short but happy time and a tumultuous upbringing. His grandmother helped him get a dishwashing job at a nearby retirement home, and he sold cookie dough for a door-to-door nonprofit organization on the side, developing an acumen for sales. His grandmother gave him anything he wanted as long as he stayed in school. But he had already switched schools 10 times before his 16th birthday, often butting heads with his teachers. One memorable clash with authority came during a class discussion that spiraled into a debate about who had been persecuted most, African Americans, Native Americans, or Jews. The exchange grew so heated that Ronnie was asked to leave the classroom, which he did, forcefully pushing the door on his way out in a way the teacher perceived as threatening. The incident culminated in a fine and his first juvenile probation stint. "I play those incidents over and over in my head," he said, of his first few legal charges. "If I had never drove that girl's car and then the car with the stolen goods, I could have probably been in the military now and having a regular life." Jobs were hard to get. Because of Ronnie's felony record, his applications were turned down by Burger King, McDonald's, Walmart, and Lowe's. For a time, he worked at Food Lion in Maryland, driving an hour each way to get there. A cousin introduced him to cocaine dealing, he said, whereupon Ronnie realized that he could stock shelves for 2 weeks and not come close to making what he could dealing drugs in a single day. The math was irresistible. Ronnie said he hated hard drugs and didn't want to end up like his dad, so he drank only on his birthday and New Year's Eve and eschewed marijuana entirely. But dealing drugs gave him the two things he craved most, money and respect. He says he was profiled in early 2000 when he and a black friend were pulled over on Interstate 66 near Herndon, Virginia, and naively consented to being searched, ostensibly for not having a county sticker on their car. They were driving a car with Maryland plates, he said. Police found 3 grams of crack cocaine tucked into his sock. "I was guilty," Ronnie said. "I did have the drugs." Bonded out of jail by his grandmother, he was arrested a short time later for selling drugs to an undercover cop, and the 2 state charges, plus a probation violation, combined for a state prison sentence of 8.5 years. "His court-appointed attorney was overworked and just wanted to get me over with," Jones said. He didn't answer the letters Jones wrote about his case from jail. He was encouraged to accept the prosecutor's first plea deal and to remain mum in court. This was 2001, a time when prosecutors across the country were doubling the number of felonies they filed in state courts despite declining crime rates. In his 2017 book, Locked In, Fordham Law School professor John F. Paff argues that it's politically safer and economically cheaper to charge a person with a felony which sends them to prison on the state's dime than it is to incarcerate someone locally or put them on probation paid for by local budgets. No matter where you turn in this epidemic, East Tennessee State University public health professor Robert Pack told me, there are systems in place to address the problems, but none of them are working together. The biggest barrier to collaboration is the fact that everyone involved views the problem too rigidly through the lens of how they get paid, according to Pack. Ronnie finished high school in jail, then took computer repair classes in the state prison system, earning a GPA of 3.6. He tutored other inmates working toward their GEDs and earned a certificate in computer repair tech. His goal was to get a job as a certified network administrator, maybe land a government job. His brother's career was on a high when Ronnie got out of prison in 2008. Thomas, also known by the stage name Big Pooh, had been traveling in Asia on a contract with Atlantic Records, recording with the rap band Little Brother. "I gave him $5,000 for a laptop and helped him get on his feet," Thomas told me. Ronnie was working for T-Mobile, selling cell phones for a time, but grew frustrated that he wasn't advancing in the company, a failure that he attributed to his record. He was too impatient, too clever by half. "I kept telling him, man, the system is set up for you to fail," Thomas recalled. "Just be happy you found some employment, because most people who are felons can't." Ronnie has a knack for quickly reading people and knowing how to talk to them and reel them in. "I said, you just got to work that opportunity till you get another one." But it wasn't fast enough for him. Thomas was on the road in 2010 when he took another collect call from Ronnie. His brother had been locked up again, this time for credit card fraud. I was like, come on, we just did all this stuff trying to help you get on your feet, Thomas remembered, exasperated. Thomas rapped about devotion and disappointment in a song called Real Love from an acclaimed solo album released in 2011. Brother, wrong or right, the fact that you are incarcerated after being free let me know you never made it to that point where the old you is not outdated. No matter how this picture looks, I'm still putting money on your books. I told you, we family. It was a credit card fraud charge that landed Ronnie in the diversion program at George's Chicken, and for a time, following his release from it, his family believed he had turned a corner. He told his brother and mom he'd launch a computer repair startup, which was certainly within his abilities, given the skills he'd picked up in prison programs. Thomas's own business was in a lull at the moment, so Ronnie floated the idea of starting a joint venture. He wanted Thomas's help opening a Caribbean jerk chicken restaurant in Winchester. He didn't turn to his brother because he needed the money. Ronnie needed Thomas's help securing a liquor license, which wasn't possible for a felon. Thomas said, I didn't understand the urgency for him wanting to buy something legitimate. I just kept saying, I don't live in Virginia, and I'm not going to have my name on nobody's liquor license, and I can't be there. And anyway, who's going to come to a restaurant in this dead little small town? Thomas began doubting his brother during their final visit when Ronnie and a girlfriend drove to Charlotte to see him and his wife. I'm like, I don't know if the computer business is this good. He had a Mercedes-Benz truck, and he had a motorcycle that he really couldn't ride, and another car back at home, Thomas said. He wondered if the girlfriend, who worked at a federal agency, owned some of the vehicles, but admits that he didn't really want to know. Thomas now believes his brother was trying to phase out of drug dealing so that if and when he got arrested, there would be a legitimate revenue stream already established to help support his daughters. Ronnie Jones has frustrated his younger brother his entire life, and that pattern of behavior included his initial refusal to cooperate with Bill Metcalf and Don Waltice, the ATF agent and prosecutor responsible for his conviction. Ronnie thought he deserved a 10-year sentence, so he fired his first court-appointed attorney, Sherwin Jacobs, who'd negotiated a plea deal of 15 years with Waltice, a decision Ronnie regretted the moment it backfired. Thomas was on a month-long European touring stint when a relative texted him the stomach-sinking news that Ronnie's federal sentence was in 23 years. I told him, the last to talk is always the last to walk, Thomas said. Though he's never been in legal trouble, Thomas said he is regularly profiled, pulled over ostensibly for speeding, presumably because he's a 30-something black man with tattoos, driving a Lexus through his middle-class Charlotte neighborhood. Though the experience is frightening, he always looks forward to the moment in the exchange when the officer runs his license and it comes back crystal clean, with the vehicle registered to his wife, a third-generation operator of a successful bail bonding company. He said, I don't have the leverage to get smart or act crazy when I get pulled over. My goal every day is to make it back to my wife in one piece so I can live to fight another day. So I'm just yes, sir, no, sir, and all that. He feels for Ronnie and other ex-offenders getting out of prison. He said, they don't rehabilitate you in prison, and they don't make it easy for you to get a job. I truly believe they don't make it easy because they want you back. And they want you back because that's the new factory work in so many places now, the prison. You have to be very strong mentally when you get out to not make those same mistakes. Ronnie Jones said he initially felt welcomed in Woodstock. When he first landed there to work in 2012, he found it charming that drivers waved to one another on the country roads, and his minimum wage paycheck from George's Chicken went further than it had in the city. He told me, it was almost a culture shocker for me. I could count on one hand the number of black people. I loved it. I actually thought I couldn't get into anything there. He didn't even mind the early shift, he said. Even though you're standing in chicken shit and you be dealing with them while they're live and they be scared. He kept working at George's after his 21-week diversion sentence was complete, but lost the job several months later when he got sick and had to be hospitalized for a week. At the time, he hoped to open a small diner with 10 chairs. He'd learned to cook from his mother, and his first job at the diversion center where he worked before going to George's had been as a cook. But no one would rent to him. He said the same thing happened when he contacted a landlord about renting space for a computer repair shop and was told the space was already leased. I got a white girl to call, and he was willing to rent to her, and I was like, this is bullshit. At the time, he owed $5,000 in medical bills and $20,000 in court fines and restitution. Jurisdictions across the country increasingly inhibit ex-offenders' ability to reenter society by assessing hefty court fines and fees, requiring them to pay thousands or face more jail time. Jones was hired at another chicken plant, but netted only $300 to $400 a week. He said, I was at the second chicken plant for less than 30 days before I decided, I'm making too much money. Let me concentrate on this. He decided to deal drugs full time, temporarily, he told himself, until he could pay off his fines and go legit, he said. In a convoluted feat of logic twisting, Ronnie justified his heroin enterprise by declaring himself the ring's wholesaler, far removed from the moment the needle touched the vein. He clings to the narrative that he was providing an actual service, offering the drug cheaper and in a much safer environment than Baltimore. Like Purdue Pharma announcing it had created the perfect time-release painkiller that was addictive in less than 1% of cases, and then reproaching the hordes of addicted people who misused its drug, Ronnie had an easy time shifting the blame, with responsibility often lost in the cloudy penumbra of bureaucratic disconnects and cops and dealers whack-a-mole. If you were a user dealer, you would, employing Ronnie's model, buy your heroin from his sub-dealers for $100 a gram, which was substantially cheaper than driving to Baltimore and paying $150, plus it saved you the driving time and the risk of dealing with armed inner-city dealers, though Ronnie and some of his lieutenants were also armed. Heroin was already there, he insisted. A truth confirmed in interviews with survivors of people who died of heroin overdose before Ronnie arrived in Woodstock. I never introduced heroin to the area. The only thing I did, I gave it to him at a cheaper price. Ronnie believes he was made out to be a monster in the federal government's case against him, vehemently denying that he had sex with underage females and dope-sick users, an accusation that Waltice said fueled him and the task force in their quest to put him behind bars for many years and possibly even for life. Ronnie said, I would pay for sex before I'd have sex with someone doing drugs. Jacobs, the fired first attorney, believes Ronnie on this point, even as he called him a con man and a pain in the ass. Jacobs saw Ronnie as someone who dealt drugs because it was easier than working, he said, and you can be a big guy in your own eyes and people follow you and it's like you're the head of a business, which you are, until it all comes crashing down. Female user dealers are incentivized to lie in their quest for what the government calls substantial assistance, and they exaggerate their addictions so they'll be given less time, according to Jones and Jacobs. Keith Marshall, the dealer whose expletive, fuck you, bring it, gave the case its informal name, said the women not only cooperated for less time, but also played up their addictions to their advantage. When Kareem Shaw's girlfriend was arrested, Marshall said, she batted her eyes and talked about how she was just an addict forced into this and used up by everybody, when the reality was quite the opposite. She was selling and setting up new people to move drugs just like myself, Marshall told me in an email, mad that she'd gotten a lighter sentence than him and was due to be released from prison in late 2018. Ronnie turns the case over in his mind, including his own complicity. He said, I promised myself I'd never grow up to be like my father, and while I may not have an addiction to an actual drug, I do feel my addiction, he said. I'm addicted to that lifestyle. It wasn't my intention. I didn't want to do it, but no one would give me a job in the field I trained for, and no one would let me create my own. He was disappointed in himself and felt bad about hurting his relatives, especially his daughters. He no longer has relationships with their mothers, one of whom told me, Ronnie was just not mentally mature enough to be a father. His biggest thing was he felt entitled. Ronnie ended the interview with a version of the same old Saul I'd heard at so many of my stops along the heroin highway. He predicted that 10 more dealers would pop up to take my place, which was accurate. It was hard to envision a future where shit in fact stopped. It was a long drive back to Roanoke. I was too tired to stop in Woodstock, where I'd arranged to meet with Christy. She was eager to learn what light Ronnie had shed on Jesse's death, but I dreaded telling her just how little he seemed to think or care about the victims of his crimes. Since our last meeting, she had arranged to view the pictures police took of Jesse lying dead on the floor. He looked surprisingly peaceful. What I'd been imagining was actually much worse, she said. When Sergeant Lutz called them up for her on his computer screen, the task force had noted a lull in overdose deaths in the wake of the prosecution of Ronnie Jones and others in the Fubi Ring. But that was also before fentanyl and other synthetic analogs came roaring onto the scene. Christy still went by her son's grave, overlooking the football field, several times a month, less often since her family moved to the other side of the county. But she still decorated it for every holiday. I feel bad every day that I don't go, she said. She had recently met Dennis Painter's son, the curly-haired toddler named for Jesse. His mother, Courtney, had awakened him in his car seat after she and Christy ran into each other at the dollar store. He woke up reaching for me, Christy said, as if it were Jesse reaching out from beyond the grave. I got in my car and cried for 10 minutes. It was almost 3 years since Jesse's death. His grave was now decorated with red, white, and blue pinwheels, an American flag, and a brand new 55 metal sculpture painted in school colors. Over the next year, Christy would hatch plans for a memorial 5-kilometer race for opioid awareness that she envisioned meandering past Jesse's old football field and the Shenandoah River. Photos of overdose victims, including another friend of Jesse's who had recently died, would be placed along the runner's path. The money raised would benefit the area's Substance Abuse Coalition. In 1 week in October 2016, 19 people in the northern Shenandoah Valley region would overdose, 17 of them brought back with Narcan. Baltimore dealers continued to hot-pack their heroin with fentanyl, an area naloxone trainer told me, because when someone dies, customers flock to his or her dealer chasing a better high. It's like I might lose 3 of my customers, but in the long run, I'll gain 10 of yours, theorized the trainer, a mom who'd lost a son to fentanyl-laced heroin. The fentanyl packing strategy is also sometimes employed with known snitches or suspected confidential informants, the goal being to kill them. After a day passed, I tried to break the news gently to Christy over the phone that Ronnie hadn't even recognized Jesse's name. In that respect, Ronnie Jones was no different than the drug reps in their tailored suits and SUVs. He had failed to see the harm his drugs had caused. And why should he be any different? A few months before, I sat down with Ronnie. Purdue Pharma executive J. David Haddix gave a speech urging members of the Richmond Academy of Medicine not to be swayed by the narrative taking shape around the opioid epidemic. His company was working to create new and safer painkillers, he said. The assembled doctors were unimpressed. What can we do, they wanted to know, when our patients need pain relief, but we don't want them to become addicts? Haddix could only suggest using local pain specialists, including the friend of his who'd invited him down to deliver the speech. But there weren't enough pain specialists, and the doctors were increasingly aware of studies showing that long-term opioids in fact created more pain in many patients, a condition known as opioid-induced hyperalgesia. 8 years after the 2007 sentencing of the company and 3 top executives for criminal misbranding, more lawsuits were being filed against Purdue and/or other opioid makers and distributors by the month, and they would grow to include such plaintiffs as the City of Everett, Washington, the State of Ohio, Cabell County, West Virginia, and Virginia's tiny Dickinson County, not far from Lee. Purdue had followed Big Tobacco's playbook when it downplayed the risk of its drug, and now some of America's best legal minds were trying to make it and other pharmaceutical companies pay for the public nuisance burdening their communities. The states of West Virginia and Kentucky had already garnered modest settlement payments from Purdue to the tune of $10 million and $24 million, respectively. Victories that brought to mind the civil litigation brought by 46 states and 6 other jurisdictions against the tobacco industry in 1998. Cigarette companies then agreed to pay billions to the states in perpetuity for the funding of prevention and public health programs. But painkillers aren't tobacco, and the cases differ, partly because opioids have legitimate medical benefits when prescribed and used correctly. And the companies who make them use as fall guys the out-of-work coal miners and furniture makers and under-challenged youth who have illegally abused and diverted their drugs. The cigarette companies finally caved, but only because the litigation costs were eating them alive, said legal scholar Richard Osnes at the University of Kentucky. He foresaw the possibility of such a settlement being forged with opioid makers, but to a much smaller degree. He said, "It's a tough call because you want to punish them, but you may not want to put them out of business because then you're largely foregoing the right to any future claims." Tightening new opioid prescriptions through physician monitoring programs, then shifting the government's focus to treatment and prevention were more effective strategies than litigation, Osnes believed. Haddocks punctuated his talk with slides touting the work Purdue was undertaking to create new, quote, safer painkillers. When his 30-minute speech was over, the general practitioners in the audience grumbled a bit. Despite Haddocks's great slides and optimistic plans for new and improved opioids, the doctors were still slogging it out in the trenches. They knew they'd be the ones left holding the prescription pads when it came time to juggle their patients' pleas for pain relief and addiction treatment with their patient satisfaction ratings still used by many insurers to gauge reimbursements. But Haddocks remained firmly on point. "What's getting lost here is the prevalence of chronic pain in this country," he said. The optics of the opioid epidemic had clearly been bad for business. While Ronnie turned gray in prison and Christy prepared the next seasonal decorations for Jesse's grave, the Sacklers' rank among America's richest families slid from 16th to 19th on the Forbes magazine list. Chapter 13. Outcasts and Inroads. If you want to treat an illness that has no easy cure, first of all, treat it with hope. Psychiatrist George Valiant, Harvard Medical School. In 1925, the psychiatrist Lawrence Kolb Sr. published a set of groundbreaking articles arguing that addiction afflicted only people who were born with personality defects. He distinguished between normal users who had been prescribed opiates by their doctors and users who were vicious, a word deriving from vice, who had become addicted via illicit channels. The latter were much worse than the former, he initially believed. And this notion led him to categorize the addicted person as a criminal rather than a patient deserving of treatment and care. In the mid to late 1930s, Kolb oversaw the opening of two U.S. narcotics farms in Lexington, Kentucky, and Fort Worth, Texas, part of the federal government's so-called New Deal for the drug addict. In bucolic rural settings, the government provided treatment both to the addicted who had arrived by court mandate and those who had volunteered, along with job training and medical care. Meanwhile, the government scientists were allowed to conduct research on the farm's captive populations. Kolb changed his beliefs about addiction after his colleagues proved to him that, quote, normal people, including the 10 to 15% of patients who were healthcare professionals, could become addicted too, if they were opioid exposed. The work at the narcotics farm labs led to the field of addiction medicine. Both farms closed in the mid-1970s due to an ethics scandal over experimentation on the addicted who were improperly exploited as research subjects. But their legacy includes the establishment of the National Institute on Drug Abuse and the scientific notion that addiction is a chronic, relapse-ridden disease. Today, courts largely continue to send the addicted to prisons when reliable treatment is difficult to secure, and many drug courts controlled by elected prosecutors still refuse to allow MAT, even though every significant scientific study supports its use. Not every patient wants or needs maintenance drugs because every human experiences addiction differently, and what works for one might not work for another. Still, it is crucial to preserve treatments for people with addiction and help them obtain the means needed to get off drugs, rather than simply treat them as criminals who have no right to health care. If my own child were turning tricks on the streets, enslaved not only by the drug but also criminal dealers and pimps, I would want her to have the benefit of maintenance drugs, even if she sometimes misused them or otherwise figured out how to glean a subtle high from the experience. If my child's fear of dope sickness was so outsized that she refused even MAT, I would want her to have access to clean needles that prevented her from getting HIV and or hepatitis C and potentially spreading them to others. As the science historian Nancy D. Campbell, who documented Kolb's work, has written, perhaps a day will come when more sensible views prevail, that relapse is the norm, that drug addiction should be treated as a chronic relapsing problem that affects the public health, and that meeting people's basic needs will dampen their enthusiasm for drugs. But there is so much more work to be done. Why, in less than two decades, had the epidemic been allowed to fester and to gain force? Why would it take until 2016 for the CDC to announce voluntary prescribing guidelines, strongly suggesting that doctors severely limit the use of opioids for chronic pain? Recommendations that echoed, almost to the word, what Barbara Van Rooyen begged the FDA to enact a decade before? Why did the American Medical Association wait two decades before endorsing the removal of pain as a fifth vital sign from its standards of care? If three-fourths of all opioid prescriptions still go unused, becoming targets for medicine chest thievery, why do surgeons still prescribe so many of the things? While it is true that doctor junkets funded by Big Pharma are no longer the norm, and physicians no longer ask reps to sponsor their kids' birthday parties, more than half of all patients taking OxyContin are still on dosages higher than the CDC suggests. And many patients in legitimate pain stabilized by the drugs believe the pendulum has swung too far the other way. A journalist and former colleague of mine was so worried about the epidemic's chilling effect on painkillers that she emailed me an X-ray of her back, showing a 64-degree curve in her lumbar spine. From the front, it resembled a question mark. And slipped discs that cause severe arthritis pain. Painkillers had allowed her to work and actively pursue gardening, cooking, and beekeeping, and they precluded risky and potentially debilitating surgery. And yet her scoliosis specialist had recently discontinued her pain management without any notice and with no discussion during appointments to come up with a pain management strategy, she said, because the new CDC guideline frightened him into abandoning his patients, she said. For her arthritis, she takes the synthetic opioid tramadol. For neuropathy, she takes the seizure medication gabapentin, which is increasingly sought on the black market for its sedative effects. My life is not less important than that of an addict, my friend wrote, in bold letters, explaining that her new practitioner requires her to submit to pill counts, lower dose prescriptions, and more frequent visits for refills, which increase her out-of-pocket expense. She said, the system taking shape treats me like an addict, like a morally dubious person who must be treated with the utmost suspicion. The CDC guideline had become so controversial among pain patients that the two employees charged with drafting it received death threats. To follow the physician's imperative of do no harm in a landscape dominated by Big Pharma and its marketing priorities, the medical community only recently organized behind renewed efforts to limit opioid prescribing, teach new doctors about the nuances of managing pain, and treat the addicted left in the epidemic's wake. The number of residency programs in the field of addiction medicine has grown in recent years from a dozen to 18. We live in an era where for a century now, the pharmaceutical industry has invested enormous capital investments in new drugs, and there's no turning back that clock, said Caroline Jean Acker, an addiction historian. So as a society, we're going to have to learn to live with possibly dangerous or at least risky new drugs, because Big Pharma's going to keep churning them out. The birthplace of the modern opioid epidemic, Central Appalachia, deserves the final word in this story. It is, after all, the place where I witnessed the holiest jumble of unmet needs, where I shadowed yet more angels in the form of worn-out EMTs and preachers, probation officers, and nurse practitioners. Whether they were attending fiery public hearings to advocate for more public spending, serving suppers to the addicted in church basements, or driving creaky RVs-turned-mobile clinics around hairpin curves, they were acting in accordance with the scripture that nurse practitioner Teresa Gardner Tyson had embroidered on the back of her white coat. Verily, I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. Matthew 25:40. One three-day weekend every summer in far southwest Virginia, Tyson plays host to the nation's largest free medical outreach event. Held at the Wise County Fairgrounds, Remote Area Medical serves the uninsured, from children with undiagnosed diabetes to adults on walkers with infected teeth, some caused by lack of dental coverage and others by years of meth use. It's where I cross paths with people like Craig Adams, a construction worker and recovering opioid addict who brought his wife Crystal to RAM so they could both get their teeth fixed. They'd used so many tubes of temporary dental repair glue, he told me, they'd lost count. Craig had spent 8 years in the state prison system for breaking into Randy's Gateway Pharmacy in nearby Richlands, trying to steal OxyContin. But he was taking Suboxone now, responsibly, he told me, because my wife wouldn't have it any other way. Having lost scores of people to opioid overdose, including his mom and grandmother, he hadn't used illicit drugs in more than 3 years. He said, I had put off going to RAM for years, because I figured they'd make you feel like shit about yourself, like 90% of the social service people do. But everyone here was just so kind. If there's an argument to be made for a single-payer healthcare system with mental health and substance abuse coverage, this is the lumpy ground on which to make it. A gravel lot in which upward of 3,000 Appalachians camp out for days in 100-degree heat to be treated in exam rooms cobbled together from bed sheets and clothespins. Behind a banner for the Virginia-Kentucky District Fair and Horse Show, patients wait in bleachers while volunteers pass out bottles of water as they triage them to pop-up clinics for medical, dental, and eye care. I interviewed Tyson several times in the spring and summer of 2017, before and after the July RAM event that her organization helps plan and host. In the weeks leading up to it, she liaised with media from as far away as Holland and made frantic phone calls once when her assistant struck out trying to secure enough bottled water for the RAM crowds. A nonprofit they usually counted on said this year's pallets were already reserved for natural disaster relief. If this isn't a disaster, I don't know what is, Tyson said, managing to sound both desperate and upbeat. In rural America, where overdose rates are still 50% higher than in urban areas, the third world disaster imagery is apt, although the state of health of RAM patients was actually far worse. In Central America, they're eating beans and rice and walking everywhere, a volunteer doctor told the New York Times reporter sent to cover the event. They're not drinking Mountain Dew and eating candy. They're not having an epidemic of obesity and diabetes and lung cancer. I had made a similar comparison 2 years before when Art Van Zee drove me through the coal camps on my first visit to Lee County, just west of Wise. Though I covered immigration in rural Mexico and the cholera epidemic in northern Haiti, I told him, never before had I witnessed desolation at this scale, less than 4 hours from my house. Most of America would be shocked by the caved-in structures with their cracked windows and Confederate flags and burnt-out houses that nobody bothered to board up or tear down. It felt completely out of scale with the rest of the nation I knew. But these conditions were hardly limited to St. Charles or Wise County, Van Zee pointed out. On the other side of the cities many Americans live in, there's poverty and poor health probably just as bad, he said. In Appalachia, he conceded, poverty and poor health were not only harder to camouflage, they were increasingly harder to recover from. For decades, black poverty had been concentrated in urban zones, a byproduct of earlier inner-city deindustrialization, racial segregation, and urban renewal projects of the 1950s and 1960s that decimated black neighborhoods and made them natural markets for heroin and cocaine. Whites had historically been more likely to live in spread-out settings that were less marred by social problems, but in much of rural America, that was clearly no longer the case. These were the same counties where Donald Trump performed best in the 2016 election, the places with the most economic distress and the highest rates of drug, alcohol, and suicide mortality. The national media's collective jaw-dropping at the enormity of needs displayed at the RAM event underscored the fact that the outside world had zero clue. As the Appalachian writer and